Barry and Colin's kiss in EastEnders in 1987 caused an absolute uproar. It's interesting, though, that that wasn't the first gay kiss on UK television. The Asian gay man, Waris Hussein, was the first director of Doctor Who.
Two of the people I loved growing up were Larry Grayson and John Inman.
There are so many issues that we still do face that need a forum for some serious debate.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Two U.S. queer icons and a hero fall to COVID-19, the International AIDS Conference goes virtual for safety, and more about the LGBTQ history of the BBC. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Laura Dickinson-Turner.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 28, 2020. The first news of high-profile LGBTQ people dying from COVID-19 is coming in. Perhaps the most prominent is famed U.S. playwright Terrence McNally, who reportedly died at a hospital in Sarasota, Florida on March 24th. The four-time Tony Award winner's voluminous credits include Love, Valor, Compassion, about 8 gay men spending 3 different summer holiday weekends together during the age of AIDS. He also wrote the books for Broadway's Kiss of the Spider-Woman, Ragtime, The Full Monty, and several others. McNally was 81. He lost his first longtime partner, Gary Bonasort, to HIV/AIDS in 2000. McNally is survived by his producer husband, Tom Curtihy.
Tributes are also pouring in for a favorite in the New York City drag scene, who also succumbed to COVID-19 this week. Muscular African-American entertainer Nassim Wooden was known by the drag name Mona Foote. He may be best known for appearing in a gold, shimmering Wonder Woman outfit in the style of the title character from the 1970s TV show. Wooden and his band The Ones made it big on Australia's music charts in 2001 with a club anthem called Flawless. His close friend and Project Runway designer Jeffrey Mack confirmed Wooden's death from COVID-19 in an Instagram video. Wooden was only 50 years old.
And the first New York City nurse to die from COVID-19 was a gay man, Keyes Kelly. According to the New York Times, Kelly worked as an assistant nurse manager at Manhattan's Mount Sinai West. He died at the age of 48 on March 24th. Many of Kelly's co-workers lit up social media, charging that his COVID-19 infection was due in part to the lack of sufficient personal protective equipment, including masks and gowns. He had asthma, but was otherwise in good health. Kelly's sister, Mariah Patrice Chiron, wrote on Facebook that his death could have been prevented. Please help get our healthcare workers the protection they need.
The 2020 International Conference on AIDS will be a virtual meeting instead of a gathering in the San Francisco, Oakland, California area in early July. Organizers say in a statement on their website that meeting online will enable delegates to access and engage with the latest HIV science, advocacy, and knowledge traditionally presented at the conference.
Meanwhile, 17 U.S. senators and the queer media watchdog group GLAAD are calling on the Food and Drug Administration to reconsider its blood donation restrictions. FDA regulations include a blanket ban on donations from men who've had sex with men in the previous 12 months. U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams and others have been pleading for blood donations to shore up waning supplies during the COVID-19 pandemic. The senator's March 26th letter leans on that point. Lesbian Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin was reportedly the spearhead, along with former presidential hopefuls Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts and Cory Booker of New Jersey. Other signatories include former presidential candidates Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota and Kamala Harris of California, and remaining candidate Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. GLAAD has a petition online demanding that the FDA remove the ban. GLAAD President Sarah Kate Ellis echoes the petition in a statement, saying, "The FDA needs to put science above stigma." A note from the Sydney Star-Observer, Australia has the same 12-month celibacy requirement for gay and bisexual men who want to donate blood.
There's been a surge in the number of calls to the UK-based LGBT Foundation's helpline since the beginning of the COVID-19 crisis. Pink News reports that calls have more than doubled from this time last year. In addition to dealing with severe anxiety and concern over the pandemic itself, several calls came from LGBTQ young people stuck in self-isolation with abusive family members. Other callers are being forced to stay at home with an abusive partner. The helpline at 0345-330-3030 is now operating remotely, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday, and the organization says it will soon cover evening and weekend hours. They can also be reached via email at helpline@lgbt.foundation. COVID-19 stress is also making life less healthy for international rainbow families. Advocacy groups are warning that global border closures prompted by the pandemic are leaving some queer couples separated. Some couples are stranded together or individually in a foreign country with their surrogate as she nears the birth of their child. Other parents will completely miss their surrogacy birth in another land. Elsewhere, if U.S. President Donald Trump has been slow to catch on, his Brazilian doppelganger is even farther behind. Claiming machismo over COVID-19, far-right President Jair Bolsonaro is condemning what he labels fear-mongering, and he's calling for an end to regional lockdowns.
Even the worldwide pandemic does not slow down the Trump administration's concerted campaign against LGBTQ rights. The U.S. Justice Department, under Trump crony Attorney General William Barr, filed a statement of interest this week supporting a lawsuit to block trans girls from competing as girls in school sports. The suit, on behalf of three Connecticut students, was brought by the Alliance Defending Freedom. That's a far-right religious group with a long rap sheet of anti-queer legal interventions. They argue that the policy of the Connecticut Interscholastic Athletic Conference is unfair to cisgender girls who have to compete against transgender girls. The American Civil Liberties Union represents two transgender athletes who run track in Connecticut. Attorney Chase Strangio lamented that rather than enjoying the last track season of their senior year, the girls now have to contend with the federal government arguing against their right to equal educational opportunities. COVID-19 is currently keeping anyone from competing. State school athletic officials have yet to decide whether the spring track season will just be postponed or canceled altogether.
In more liberating news, Argentina has its first transgender news anchor. 40-year-old reporter Diana Zurko made history with her debut as co-anchor of the nation's public television evening news program on March 23rd. Zurko told the Associated Press, "Behind me, there are more people like me who want to express themselves. We are capable, we can study, we can train ourselves, we can communicate to you what is happening in our country." Rosario Lufrano of Radio and Television Argentina said that Zurko was not chosen because she was trans, but because she was a very good professional.
Another Argentinian was among at least three notable people who fled the closet this month. 31-year-old Sebastian Vega plays for his hometown, Gimnasia de Comodoro, in one of the country's top leagues. He came out in a lengthy social media post this week. The reaction from teammates and most others has been positive. Vega told Reuters, "I was really scared, but the fear didn't paralyze me. I felt truly free. It had been a long time since I'd walked without such a heavy weight on my shoulders."
One of track and field's most accomplished competitors hop-skip-jumped out this week. Ireland's triple jump specialist Dennis Finnegan is the winner of 10 national titles. The 33-year-old Finnegan is currently based in Melbourne, Australia. He explains in a new Outsports podcast that being gay is just a small part of who he is as a person, and an even smaller part as an athlete. Finnegan says being out to his family and close friends, but publicly closeted, created a kind of schizophrenic tension. He hopes his coming out will help young queer athletes and give them more confidence in what they're doing.
Finally, are you ever too old to come out? Not according to one acclaimed Polish actor. Witold Sadowski concluded an interview on his life and career saying that without regret, he is proud of being an honest man and that he did not marry because, "I was born different. I'm gay. Now I have said everything, as in confession. Sadovy first appeared on the stages of Warsaw's largest theaters in 1945 and retired in 1989. He's also been in several films, written books on theater, and was a theater columnist. He survived being gay through two world wars, through Poland as a Soviet satellite, and after its independence. Sadovy holds government medals for his outstanding service to Polish culture and is a distinguished member of the Association of Polish Stage Artists. Despite increasingly ugly homophobia in Poland, Sadovy's coming out was greeted by generally supportive social media responses. He did it on his birthday to celebrate becoming the country's oldest living actor at the tender age of 100.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending March 28th, 2020. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is usually recorded in the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, but we're recording remotely during the COVID-19 emergency. The news is written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more.
And you can listen to News Wrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out Radio YouTube channel. For This Way Out, I'm Laura Dickinson-Turner.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
Stay safe.
Last time on This Way Out...
You're with the BBC.
A fascinating project. It looks at the history of the BBC's LGBTIQ coverage, particularly in terms of how the broadcaster has understood LGBTQI issues over the years.
Hello and welcome to Gay Time TV, the first ever lesbian and gay series on the BBC.
And they said, oh, anybody think you were a lesbian yourself? And I said, well, I am. What are you going to do about it?
The British Broadcasting Corporation's John Escombe has been spearheading inclusion of LGBTQ issues in the online history of the BBC. Last time we heard about the pre- and post-law reform depictions of queer people and some of the closets behind the mics. As Escombe's conversation with This Way Out Sydney-based correspondent William Broom continues, growing up on British telly and the changes that came with liberation.
Two of my big memories growing up in England, I think there was a drama film called The Two of Us about two schoolboys who fall in love. And then, of course, there was the soap opera EastEnders.
You know, Barry and Colin's kiss in EastEnders in 1987, I mean, that caused an absolute uproar. Michael Cashman, who is now a Lord in the House of Lords and had been a member of the European Parliament before that, he played the part of Colin, and he actually had a brick thrown through his window at home. He'd had death threats. There were absolutely appalling headlines splashed across the tabloid press. And you just wouldn't get that kind of reaction now, which is fantastic. It's interesting, though, that that wasn't the first gay kiss on UK television. Back in 1974, there was a drama called Second City First's Girl. Second City First's was a sequence of half-hour dramas, again on BBC Two, the second channel. And this was a kiss between Jackie and Corporal Harvey. So basically, Jackie was leaving the army. Corporal Harvey, played by Myra Francis. Jackie was Alison Steadman, who went on to do a lot of comedy drama. And there was, you know, not just a kiss in that, but an obvious relationship in that drama. And that was 1974. Now, as far as I'm aware, that didn't cause a great uproar. It wasn't peak time. Again, 5 to 10 on a Friday evening, so hidden somewhat. But the reaction was more muted then. That was more or less 10 years before.
What about the representation of drag? I think in 1938, Douglas Bing was the first female impersonator on TV. And then, of course, from the 1950s, you had Mrs. Shufflewick.
Hello, my lovelies.
What role has drag played?
Well, of course, in the UK, drag has always had a place and, you know, in pantomime, at the very least, is always very prominent. Remember, the UK was the first country to have a regular television service before the war, started in 1936, all live, of course. They couldn't record programmes, so they could show film inserts. But in 1938, as you say, one television channel, around about 300,000 to 400,000 viewers at its peak, finally, before the war. So 1938, that was the kind of audience you're talking about, mainly in the south of England. Douglas Bing was the first female impersonator on television, and he'd come from the theatrical world. He'd had a drag act, and he was discovered. There were basically talent scouts who used to go into the West End shows and look for people to appear on television. They would say, come up and do your act that you've just done in the West End during the day, and go back and do your show in the evening, but come and do us half an hour television in the afternoon. And Douglas Bing did that. He actually kept going with his act until about 1977. He was 90 when he finally came up. So there were some early appearances of men in drag, because I think there was this tradition that had been established. And so, you know, it wasn't considered too frightening for the BBC.
We were talking about lesbian representation earlier, and I can't think of many. I think back in the 1920s, Dame Ethel Smith and Naomi Jacobs, who were composers, I think some of their music was played on the radio. And of course, there was Nancy Spain, who I think was on Jukebox Jury in What's My Line?
Absolutely, yes. But were they identified as out lesbians? Absolutely
no.
Not. Unless you knew of them personally, potentially, you would never have known. Radio and early pre-war television were staffed by LGBTQ plus people because they'd come from the theatre, that, you know, very stereotypical safe haven for our community. And that did spill over into television and radio. Interestingly, more so in radio. I've been listening to an interview recently that we did with Waris Hussein, who was the first director of Doctor Who. A gay man, Asian gay man, who worked for the BBC in the 1960s, joined the trainee scheme for directors in 1962. A fascinating interview. He spoke for about 2.5 hours, uninterrupted. Wow. We had a 5-minute break. He's an 83-year-old man with fantastic recall, amazing stories about being a gay man in the 60s in broadcasting and then going into film and commercial television later. And he said basically radio was where it was at, if you knew where at was at all, because it was still very hidden in terms of the BBC as an employer of gay people. He was saying basically, you know, you said nothing, you did nothing. It all happened outside of the BBC premises and very little acknowledgement, you know. Although he joined BBC Two, which was a young and kind of youthful-looking television channel, which started in the mid-1960s, 1964, beginning of swinging 60s, it was still run by quite an establishment BBC, which was quite traditional, its outlook. And basically, homosexuality was still illegal till 1967. So any expression puts you under the spotlight.
Apart from the book Broadcasting It by Keith Howells, I find TV often dominates the narrative. Do you think radio gets rather ignored?
Well, radio gets ignored, I think, quite a bit in terms of general history in any case. But there are academics devoted to the history of radio broadcasting. But certainly it's always has attracted kind of less analysis, shall we say, which is a great shame, because radio is a hugely rich medium, particularly, I think, in the countries where you have a public service tradition, where often the public service broadcaster began with a speech network, which began a kind of culture of speech program making, drama radio program making, comedy radio program making, where at least some of the LGBTQI plus elements, expression, to really flourish here, at least in the BBC, and I know in other public service broadcasters around the world.
The conversation continues after this brief intermission.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
There's nothing cooler than the world's only international LGBT radio magazine.
Unless it's thiswayout.org.
At thiswayout.org, you'll find program information,
related videos,
expanded features,
news wrap transcripts,
CDs, and downloadable material.
It might not be cooler than radio,
but there's much more This Way Out at thiswayout.org.
We now return to William Broom's chat with the BBC's John Escombe about the national broadcaster's coverage of LGBTQ issues.
Ground floor perfumery, stationery and leather goods, wigs and haberdashery, kitchenware and...
Two of the people I loved growing up were Larry Grayson and John Inman, but of course a lot of the gay liberationists didn't like them at all. But there's been a lot of revisionism lately about them and an appreciation. Where do you stand?
It's very hard because, you know, they were practically the only representation of gay men, at least, on British television in the 1970s. When you've got, you know, a television environment, when you've got, you know, three television channels, that's all we had in the UK until 1982, when a fourth one was added, big deal. The options were very, very limited. So Larry Grayson, you know, quite a camp television contest host, and John Inman playing the part of a shopkeeper in a department store, again, quite camp. Two very similar sorts of images. They didn't particularly appeal to me. I thought they were quite funny, but they didn't do a great deal for opening my horizons, particularly. When you present, you know, just one position, one view, one image of what a gay person is, a gay man, LGBTQI person is, then that can become quite confusing.
Growing up, I always found that gay men were rather effeminate, were very camp. Not that that's an issue at all, but it was the only image presented. You very rarely saw what you'd call, and it sounds awful with toxic masculinity and all that, but very strong male butch characters who were on top of their game and were very confident. We're either portrayed as almost joke characters or victims who are trying to hide away. Or if we're bisexual, we're people who cannot decide if we like men or like women. And almost always, the bisexual man will run back to the woman.
Well, these were the kind of really rigid straitjackets, I think, that programme makers were dealing in. This was the kind of currency, if you like. And I think it comes from a culture of broadcasting, which doesn't have much room to breathe. So a lot of people producing programmes at a certain period in history, churning things out, not really thinking about the audience in any kind of sophisticated way. So, you know, you never got any kind of shades of light or grey. They were either, you know, pink or black and white, it seems to me, in terms of LGBTQI people. And so the nuances were just simply absent. Now, you could say that about all sorts of coverage. The nuances are often absent, and broadcasting needs to get ever more sophisticated. And I think programme makers are looking beyond their own immediate influences, their own immediate inputs. But it takes something for someone to step back, who aren't necessarily from that particular community, to actually do something different. And I think just encouraging broadcasters, programme makers, to always think out of the box. Who's listening? I mean, you know, there's a real distinction between the North and South in the UK. And I've always thought that Radio 4, which is our predominantly our speech broadcaster station, which seems to include people only from the south of England, by and large, sounds very odd when you go and listen to it in the north of England. So there's a certain preconceived idea as to who listens to what and where. And I think when broadcasters start to think outside of themselves, that really, really helps. And I think we're heading in that direction.
Two more questions. How do you think the expectations of our LGBTIQ plus audiences have changed?
We have improved our activism and we have become more vocal and demanded more coverage. We have said, look, where are the gay characters in dramas? Where are the LGBTQI plus presenters? Where are we? and people have lobbied and people have made a good case. They shouldn't have had to have done this, but that's the way, unfortunately, the system currently has evolved. So I think our being vocal has really, really helped. And I think the sheer determination, the ongoing determination, has made programme makers wake up.
And my final killer question, what do you think the future has for LGBTQI plus programming?
Well, I don't think we're going to see the kind of dedicated magazine programmes on television that we had in the up to the mid to late 1990s.
Hello and welcome to Gay Time TV.
I think, speaking to everybody that I've been speaking to, that feels just a little bit like a kind of an anachronism. There are so many issues that we still do face that need a forum for some serious debate, and we still need to be looking at prejudice. We still need to be looking at the serious subjects. They should not be forgotten. And I'm hoping that in mainstream news, that the LGBTQI plus community has a voice, continues to have a voice, because we've made big breakthroughs in drama and in comedy, which is great. But there are still issues people are facing, and I hope that the mainstream starts to be more sophisticated and doesn't fall back into a kind of heteronormative mainstream, which was so dominant in the past. That would be a terrible future.
John Eskham from the BBC, thank you so much for joining us.
This is William Broome in Sydney, Australia, for This Way Out.
But wait, there's more. We're out of time now, but that wasn't all that John Eskham and William Broome discussed. Come hear the rest at thiswayout.org.
I had to go to dingy cellars where strangers are under suspicion and doors are closed to outsiders, in the secret world where every member is a woman.
Famously, in Strictly Come Dancing, a same-sex couple did this fantastic routine and then got 300 complaints.
Oh, and the queer part of the history of the BBC project online can be found at bbc.com/historyofthebbc/LGBTQ. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Laura Dickinson Turner and Christopher Gall, produced by Brian DeShazer, and from William Broome. Thanks also to Greg Louganis and Michael LeBeau and Sarah Sweeney. One Direction and Brad Paisley performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, James Kennedy, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Together with all our listener donors, they make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WVEW, Brattleboro, Vermont, 4BI, Fortitude Valley, Queensland, KAOS, Olympia, Washington, and a wide array of community, terrestrial, and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy and stay tuned.